Hello and welcome to the Tomorrow Brands podcast. I'm your host, Ruth Vitok, and today we ask what happens when you stop treating other brands as competition and start seeing them as collaborators. This week, I'm joined by Lottie Unwin, founder of Brand Hackers and Upworld. If you're anywhere near the startup marketing world, you've probably come across her work, or her Slack channel, her podcast, or one of the many marketeers she's helped lift out of total chaos. In this conversation, we talk about the reality of startup marketing, what founders often get wrong, why brand strategy is useless if it lives in a Google Drive, and how to build a brand without losing your mind or your margins. We also get into some big questions. What is a challenger brand anymore? Why are so many marketing teams still sidelined in their own business? And who is Sophie from Clapham, and why do we need to stop marketing to her? Let's get into it. Hi, Lottie. Thanks for coming on.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
I love chatting to you, so it's nice to record it.
Exactly. This is like us going for coffee, but in the world.
So for anyone who doesn't know you, for anyone I guess that means is not on LinkedIn, give us a little potted history of your background, what you do now, how you got there.
I'm obsessed with startup marketing. I find this like the easiest way to explain why I do so many odd things. And I started my career at Procter & Gamble, didn't know that I wanted to be a marketer, fell into marketing, basically because management consultants rejected me, and just loved it. Found my thing, found it the most intellectually stimulating, fascinating exercise, like how you get someone to buy something that they didn't think they needed. Just really got my brain going. And then I moved into startups and that was it. Like the energy and the pace and the feeling of impact got me hooked. And so today I run three businesses, one of which is a community for people in marketing called Upworld. Another is fractional marketing teams for ambitious brands called Brand Hackers. And then I run a sort of talent and recruitment business called Up Talent. So lots of stuff going on, but all of it is just around helping startup marketers or doing startup marketing or building careers for startup marketers. Like it's all just sides of exactly the same coin. And I have the best job in the world because I get to sit above all of them.
Nice. So I'm going to start with going way back to probably sometime around 2012 when we first met. And I still remember this because I was at Pop Chips and you were at Propercorn. And at the time, I saw Propercorn as our absolute sworn rivals. I don't even think you know how Propercorn we used to be in the Pop Chips office, probably because you did loads of like cool stuff. And we were like, damn it. And I remember you emailed me and said, do you want to go for coffee? And I was like, oh. The marketing from Propercorn wants to meet me. What is going on? And we met for a coffee and you said you had this idea for Copy Club, which then became the genesis of these businesses. And the sort of point of Copy Club was for marketing leads and in these same size businesses to get together and share. So suddenly I had to do this mental flip. And my boss at the time was really good at this. And he was like, you're seeing this brand as a competitor. And actually, they're not. Like, we're all building the category out together. But that was actually a really big thing for me to go from a competitive to a collaborative sort of mindset shift. And he obviously called it Copy Club. So pushing my buttons there.
That was the point, yeah. Not that it was for copywriters, which was the whole problem. But yeah, the whole point was we should be actively copying each other. I think, like that fear of competition is definitely a real issue. What I was primarily trying to do with Copy Club was to put people at a dinner next to each other who perhaps not like Propercorn and Pop Chips, where while it was fantastic that we shared notes, we were competitors in some ways. But there were a million and one businesses that we were totally non-competitive with who we weren't hanging out with either. And I just felt so strongly that actually if I sat next to someone who worked in a B2B SaaS business and they talked about the way they used email, that was what was going to give me ideas that would make my approach to healthy snacking genuinely interesting. And I guess the issue was that the people that it was easy to connect with were like the healthy snacking gang. And there became a little crew of us and we were all doing exactly the same thing, talking to the same retailers for the same share of shelf. And our work, I think, was at risk of getting really samey if that was our only field of reference. So I think on the whole, I just don't believe that there's enough time in life to worry about competition. We've all got way too much to learn and the right brands win out. But I think P&G had really taught me the importance of having mates in, I was in perfume, having a mate in Tampax and a mate in Fairy Liquid who you can go and compare notes with, and how like faster that made your job, which just was completely missing in the startup landscape.
Yeah, and I think there's something about switching your yes, Popchips and Proper Corn were competitors, and that for a consumer you're going to buy one of those in the moment on the day, but highly likely you're going to buy both of those brands over time anyway.
Yeah.
And actually switching it to who is that challenger brand mentality of the real competition here is PepsiCo or P&G or, and all of those other smaller brands. Yes, there might be certain moments where you're in direct competition, but the reality is that's not who you're stealing share from, really. You're trying to grow. And then having friends will help grow out the category. That switch from competitive to either sort of abundance mindset or just like staying in your own lane and focusing on what you're building, it's quite powerful, I think.
I think it's hugely powerful. I never managed to pull it off, but there are examples of multi-brand activations. There are case studies of where that's taken to a real extreme example. So what we didn't do was join forces and say, let's go to Tesco's together and talk about the future of the healthy snacking fixture as a group of brands. And I think that's so cool when categories manage to do that. That they're not just going for coffee, they're actually like sitting around the boardroom table together saying, look, let's like really deliver some category thinking, because we've all got shared clarity that the bigger goal here is to shake out the incumbents, is not to like scrap around for our share of something tiny.
Yeah, 100%. Do you think there's a time when a little competition is healthy or motivating?
Yes. But I think you've got to really root it in like the customer's, like the shopper journey. So as you say, someone walks into a snack aisle, they decide they're looking for something healthy, they decide they want savory because that's the mood they're in, and then they're deciding between one pop chips flavor and another popcorn flavor. They've already eliminated half the popcorn range because they've decided they want savory or whatever. At that moment, yeah, I think it's healthy. But I think most of the time, people don't recognize that their competition in the eyes of the customer is totally different to how it looks in the industry. So we always used to talk about how the biggest competition for Proper Corn was actually a coffee, because really it was like, it's 3 p.m. and if I don't stand up and look at something other than my emails, I'm going to pit someone. And what we were competing for there was like share of that boredom moment. We weren't really just up against other healthy snacks, because no one was eating Proper Corn because they were hungry. If you're hungry, you eat food that doesn't have no calories. It's made of like nothing. Yeah, exactly. It's the biggest driver was boredom, or like a feeling that I need a pick me up. And so it, like now they're probably fighting TikTok way more than they're fighting other healthy snacking brands, because it's what do you do in that moment.
That's so interesting. That is such a more interesting place to play as a marketeer, isn't it? There's so much more tension and creativity in that than there is like us versus insert other healthy snack brand.
Yeah, and I think that's the job of the marketer, because if you think about the like leadership table, no one else in that room is worrying about that landscape. Of course they're worrying about the other brand that's going to reduce their factory costs faster than you, or like the other brand that's going to negotiate a better deal with the retailer. Like their job is to worry about competitors in a very small world. Our job is to worry about competitors in the heads of our customers. And I find that, yeah, I find that a much more exciting place.
So tell me a bit more about how Upworld was born. What was the problem you were solving?
I was so lonely, like achingly miserable, because I had chatted my way into this job with no real intention of taking it. I just met some people at Proper Corn and thought I'd tell them what I really thought, which is that I thought they'd wasted loads of money on a big campaign. And turns out that like I've built a career on saying the thing, like basically saying the things that I don't think anyone else will say. And most of the time it goes quite well. And it turned out that they'd just done this post-campaign analysis and hadn't seen the outcome that they thought they'd seen. And so me saying, I don't think this is very good, fell at the right moment. And so suddenly there was a job offer and suddenly I was leaving P&G. And it was all a bit of an accident, but I thought I was going to be totally fine because I'd been spending like £16 million a year on my TV budget. A Dolce & Gabbana fragrance and beauty was 16 mil. Yeah.
Wow.
I don't know how to do that. I just told an agency to spend it and pressed a button in a system. But I thought I really knew what I was doing and I'd had a lot of training. And the fall from grace was brutal, where it was like, do influencer marketing. I didn't know what influencer marketing was. I had no idea how to negotiate it more than just tell the global media team that you wanted to do influencer marketing. And yeah, I was just completely out of my depth. And I found that being useless at work, I guess this is like being a kind of straight A student who I take things quite seriously. And so not being good at the thing I was taking really seriously completely knocked me for six. So the problem was, how do I get some solutions to this stuff? It was very practical. It was like, I'm really not doing well at work and I'm working really hard and I'm feeling awful about myself. And the way I learn is through having conversations. I've never been, like, the irony of having an English degree and not being particularly book smart. Like, I don't really find that reading was going to be my way through. And actually, nor was there any of the stuff to read. There aren't the business books on how to get someone to buy popcorn, not in a cinema. No one's written how to think like that. So I just started networking as aggressively as I could. And you were victim to one of my many, hi, can we have coffee? I was ballsy because it was giving me a feeling of a lifeline. And it was moving, my emotional space from this is just abject misery to being like, I'm doing something about this. I'm having energizing conversations. And everyone I spoke to was really reassuring in their lack of answers. No one could give me solutions to any of it. And this isn't to say like I was so reassured by everyone else being a bit crap too, but we were all just having a go and we still are all just having a go. And I found that incredibly energizing. So that was the beginning. Hosted a supper club, did all these coffees, realised that everyone was lovely and that they'd love each other, started hosting some dinners. That was all it was ever going to be. And then every day after the dinner, there'd be the emails being like, oh, I'm introducing you to whoever I met at a trade show. Can they come to the next dinner? And I was like, next dinner? Okay, fuck. Do another one. And it's just snowballed from there. And now there's 1,200 members because we're still not the only ones. There's still a lot of people. And at different levels. And the feelings change. You get more senior and you stop being uncomfortable with the feeling that you're pretending and start having some confidence that experience gets you some of the way. But we still have all of our own questions.
I think it's nice when it shifts from, I don't know what I'm doing, imposter syndrome, to, I don't know what I'm doing, growth mindset, day one thinking, whatever you want to call it. And actually, you get to a certain point where you're like, this is exciting now because this is like a new challenge rather than I just don't know and I'm completely out of my depth. And it's funny with marketing specifically, I think, because obviously there are things that work and there is strategy and playbooks, but things are constantly changing. And there are still those sort of solids that don't actually change that much, which is really reassuring that the longer you stay here.
Yeah.
It comes back round, or is that we've lived through now the sort of short term versus long and the short of it and the brand building versus performance. But yeah, there's a kind of new confidence that comes in not knowing and then and going out to people from different brands, different categories and different levels. So I think as well, speaking to more junior people who are doing that sort of fresher thinking because they are genuinely coming at it from day one is super useful as well.
I definitely think you develop coping mechanisms. So there are like ways of approaching a problem that are unchanged, whether the solution is like the latest piece of AI or putting a billboard up. And I now have confidence in my methodology, which means that, yeah, now the imposter syndrome is gone. Like now I feel very proud that I have a craft and I can teach that craft and I've still got a huge amount to learn, but I've got a structure that gets me through any brief, Which I think is experience.
It is experience. As an older person, I would say that, but I do think it's true. I think there are certain things that you can only really learn from doing it and being there. And the great thing about working in the sort of businesses that you enjoy working in and that I enjoy working in is you will get so much experience because they move so quickly that you can cram a lot. Even if you're only there a year, that year you will cram so much into that. It's almost like startup years are different from corporate years.
I think that's why when I went freelance, it was like this, if I moved to startups and had this moment of, I'm finding this really hard, but I'm never going to go back. When I went freelance, I had exactly the same transition. And it was because the sheer volume of what you were exposed to and the speed at which you were forced to learn was just so thrilling. It was such an adjustment. But to feel like I could be, startups move fast, but to think I could do five of them at once, it's like, this is amazing. There is no way I'm ever going to go back to like just having one of these experiences at once. I mean, that'd be so limiting.
Right.
Yeah.
Adrenaline junkie.
Exactly. And now I've built out this big team in Brand Hackers where we work across probably more than 100 brands a year. And that means I've got that feeling. I get to be in the P&L of more than 100 brands. They have to give me access to their Google Drive because they've signed a contract. I love that.
Like the all-seeing eye.
Yeah, it's basically just like a really over-the-top way of fulfilling my curiosity. Like, how can I justify being this nosy? And so much of my life now, I think, is just that. It's like, I host a podcast. Why? So that I have this setup that means that I can talk to people that I want to chat to who would say no otherwise. I've built an agency so that I can get in the strategic conversations of businesses that I really want to know why they're doing that. I really want to understand the context. And yeah, I just feel very fortunate that like most people will let me sign their NDAs now, which is the dream.
Hopefully they won't think twice after hearing this.
I'm still very trustworthy. I'm just here for different motives.
So talking of all of those early stage brands, those sort of 100 of them, however many there are, what, when it comes to growth, marketing, brand growth, what are the most common mistakes?
Oh, so many. I think strategy is really misunderstood as a term. I think it's thrown around way too much and is often really grandiose and therefore just not done. And we talk about simple strategy being essentially the principle of deciding what one or two things you're going to do and the list of like 2,000 rows of stuff you're not going to do. And that's all it is. And the way you do that is get really focused on what's the next thing we have to achieve as a business. And so I talk a lot about this hackneyed metaphor I've got of standing at the bottom of the north face of a mountain, and everyone just obsesses over what's going to happen when I get to the summit, or how am I going to feed myself on like night three of this hike. And the reality is, it's like you're on the floor, like you're like standing at the base of this mountain. Let's just get above the tree line, because you're going to run out of cash before you get above the tree line, or you don't have enough stock, or like you earn the right to think about what if great things happen. You don't inherit that. And I think strategy so often goes wrong because it's too overworked. It's too like, when we have 10 million customers, it's, you've got five and then your mum and your mum's friends. So let's think about what's going to get you to 1,000 customers and let's only think about that. So yeah, I think strategy is overcooked and people get distracted by theoretical problems that are a real right and a privilege, not a reality for them. I think that marketeers, like startup, like the way startups manage marketeers and startups go wrong when they like lose obsessive sight of the customer and their customer insight is woolly or generic or unspecific. I think that's, it's so rarely done to a quality that's good enough. And I think the other, like the flip side of that is the other mistake is that they lose sight of the money. So no marketing plan survives beyond the budget, survives. No marketing team survives beyond the runway. And understanding exactly what has to be true to unlock that next round of cash or unlock that next distribution channel that's going to give you the cash to stay alive, I think is like fundamental. So those are the two things I always try and hammer home to startup marketers I'm teaching, is if all you do is obsess over the customer and make that customer really tight and all you worry about is where the cash is going to come from, you'll be fine. And the mistakes are to do anything else.
And going back to what you said about strategy, I remember when I first went freelance and you were one of the first people I spoke to actually and gave me lots of good advice, some of which I still think about, being never, don't count your chickens, because which is,
yeah, until the ink is dry on the contract.
Until the ink is dry on the contract.
It is nothing.
It's nothing. But I love like brand strategy. That's my favourite bit of the job, like working out those brand problems, getting it down on a page. And I quickly found, I started calling myself a strategist, and I quickly found that was just not going to work. That people, I think because we've done a bad job of strategy, of making it, to your point, too grandiose. I have seen brand strategies that I don't understand, and I've worked in marketing now for coming up to 20 years. And then for brands, it's useless. If you can't execute on the strategy, and I guess even with Tomorrow Brands, when we first started out, we were like, we're just going to do strategy. Yes. And actually, we've ended up being really hands-on, because the strategy fails if it's not executed properly. And to be able to make that a reality is the important bit. So I feel like it gets a bad rep, but the flip side of that is that brands don't want to invest in it when that is the thing, that is a thing that underpins everything. So it doesn't have to be super complicated. It shouldn't be, in fact. It should be simple, but it is critically important. And I remember when I was first freelancing, I'd speak to brands and they'd say, we just want some social media content. It's not working. And you look at it, it's because you don't have a brand strategy. You don't know what it's saying. It's not doing a job. It needs to be informed by that. So there's this kind of balancing act, because I understand why people distrust it, but the answer isn't to throw the whole thing out.
No, but I think there's way too much of it just sitting in Google Drives.
Yeah.
Like the server space that's being taken up by strategy is why founders have a real problem with it. And I really respect that. And that's where Brand Hackers was born. So I went freelance. I was doing lots of fractional marketing director work before fractional was a word. And I just kept getting stuck at this feeling of I'm not adding value because this isn't going anywhere. Because you told me in the scoping conversations that you'd be able to execute it and that everyone would muck in, but you've got loads of other stuff going on, and fair play. And I don't blame you for that, but it's not happening. And feeling so unmotivated by it, because I think the interesting bit is where the strategy works or doesn't quite work. That's where it gets spicy, and that's where you're really challenged. Kind of knocking something up on some nice slides is easy, but like for it to work is a whole different thing. And I was really not motivated by having to walk away at the point where you like left them with the deck. So started finding different ways to be able to like stay involved and do the delivery, because as you say, it's only worth what it means in the minds of a customer.
I think what you can tell when it's good is when 6-12 months later someone comes back to you and goes, oh, that deck you did has been amazing. Because in the week after, they're like, oh, okay. And then it's when it like starts to live and breathe and become something that people refer back to. And it's the, because it should be a foundational building block, but that's when you know it's good, when it's still in use 12 months later.
And when it is in the wild, like when the execution of the brand reflects that vision. And yes, either they say that deck's really good, or they're like, what deck? And you're like, oh, you don't even, like, you can't see that the way that you now do things is because of decisions we made, and it's become like part of the DNA of a business.
You are the strategy.
Yeah.
You have become.
The deck is in your soul.
You have become.
Yeah. The other point here is the difference between brand strategy and marketing strategy. So I had a good friend of mine who's a founder. I had a conversation with him recently where he was like, oh, I want to hire my marketing team. And we were having a chat about how to structure it. And I said, can you just send me your brand and marketing strategy? And he sent me a brand pyramid. And said, I definitely don't need any more work on brand and marketing strategy, and kept repeating it. And I said, but the difference between, okay, this is your brand and what are you actually going to do to find your customer, what's your go-to-market plan, is just really misunderstood. And I think, yeah, I just think marketing's got itself in a bit of a muddle because it's this huge blob of different skills and disciplines and types of brain that's needed that all get shoved into one corner in a way that doesn't happen with other functions.
Yeah, I probably shouldn't start talking about this. I was going to go off on a rant.
Yeah. Stay calm.
Underappreciated discipline. What about the opposite? What are the green flags that tell you a brand is going to break through?
Using what I would call a secret sauce. So using one channel or one thing incredibly well. And I think that can change. So it might be as simple as incredible investor updates that mean that your investors are not just people who give you money, but are like diehard advocates and you've turned them into this word of mouth army. Or it's your TikTok reach is like way bigger than you deserve. Or you've got this like clever revenue stream from a white label. What, you know, it's like you're looking for unfair advantages. Because fundamentally, the job of a startup is to do something magical. Like our brief is take not enough money and not enough time and produce something completely disproportionate. And that's the same as can you pull a rabbit out of a hat over and over again? And so the way you do that is you have to hack that magic. You can't just like 1 + 1 can't equal 2. Somewhere in that formula, you have to do something outsized. And so I think brands that have worked out that's what they're looking for, and then seen a seed of it and run with it are the ones that are going to work. And each of those seams don't last that long necessarily. There are cases where it does. There are cases where it's brilliant at getting you like to the next goalpost, and then the goalpost has to completely flip. I talk a lot about, I did lots of work for a healthy condiments brand called Dr. Wills, and we did such a good job of that in the early stage. It was like the first thing was to get a Tesco listing. Okay, so let's be completely obsessed with getting a Tesco listing. So that's just all of this disproportionate reach in places that the Tesco buyer would see, so that the Tesco buyer thought we were the sexiest thing ever. So single-minded, did not care about end customers at all. Then we got the Tesco listing, and literally the next day it was like, oh, because someone's got to buy this. Okay. And a whole new pivot to, again, what's the secret sauce going to be for this next stage of our growth? So I guess it's executing simple strategy. So being really clear on what you're trying to do and putting all resource behind that one goal. But I do think like looking for these outsized golden threads is pretty key.
So let's talk about sort of state of play of marketing in 2025. Mm. If you were going to launch a brand in the UK right now, what would you do differently from even 2 years ago?
I would invest in content like really properly. So I would spend like 100+ grand a year on content creation and how I thought about social and organic reach from the moment I could afford it.
Do you think there's a channel or tactic that's underrated? We're about to have a renaissance. Would it be organic social in that context?
I don't think it's underrated. I think everyone knows how important it is. I think it's still seen as cheap. And there's still this hangover that you just get an intern with a phone and that means you've nailed organic social.
Does that work? Because it's cheap, but it's so tough. That's why I think...
That's my point. Yeah. I think it's still seen as... I don't think anyone's, oh, it's not important. Everyone's, it's important, but what's required, what's commonly understood as enough to do a good job of it is brands think they can get away with spending like 15, 20 grand a year on it. No, we're talking like 5-10 times that level of investment to like meaningfully play that game. I don't think this is underrated, but I'll be a broken record forever about the power of LinkedIn and personal brand as a like rocket ship for early stage founders. And I'm desperate to get like a Reddit brief. I really want to try and understand like community first, like forum marketing. And I just like Pot Gang, the gardening brand that built basically like their first, their go-to-market strategy for the first 2 years was all about neighbor, like neighbor community groups. And they were posting in like 10,000 Facebook groups a week and had this whole network of VAs who were doing this like very grassroots first approach. And I think that's super interesting. So I think underutilize like the viral effect of being where your customer is. But that's not new. That's just really old. That's going right back.
But I think that's what we said at the beginning, right? That when you've been around long enough, coming back to that sort of gnarly, hard won experience, you see these things come in and out of fashion, but the fundamentals remain. So the channels and the tactics might change, but the job and the sort of basic principles are the same. So I guess...
Absolutely. It's just where your customer is. It's no different. Like, Meta ads are no different from billboards in the Victorian times. Like, you just plaster a message where someone's looking. It's just that we've changed where we're looking.
Do you think that challenger brands are still challenging, or has it just become another aesthetic?
I think many challenger brands have become another aesthetic. Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. I think it's like the number of brands who are marketing at Sophie from Clapham, who's 25 and who does reformer Pilates and eats healthy snacks and has a beer on the common at the weekend. You're not challenging anyone. And I just, the founder conversations I love are when someone's like, my customer's 65. She lives in suburban areas in the north of England. This is her real problem. She deals with the problem this way at the moment, but it's not working for her and we have an actual solution. That is a challenger brand. They are challenging something that exists. It's not like another Shoreditch output on an iMac that works in Planet Organic and then you put it in like Tesco Hull and it really struggles. So I don't think there are no challenger brands, for sure. But I think the the irony of there being a playbook for a challenger brand, that's like an oxymoronic statement, but that's exactly where we're at.
I think people have lost sight of what challenger brand means. It doesn't mean new, young, cool brand. It means that you're challenging something, whether that be...
It means you have a really clear monster.
Incumbent, a category. I've always loved the category changing briefs. And I love the brands that have done that, like Moju, who came in and basically have created a whole new category. I love that. It's hard. It's really hard to do. And you have to have a lot of things go right. But that's a genuine challenger brand. And I remember John saying to me, the marketing director there, that his vision for the brand, he wants it to be in Greggs. And I laughed. And he was like, I'm not joking. And I was like, cool. Okay. And at that, it's not Sophie from Clapham in Reformer Pilates. It's doing something genuinely like disruptive, not... doesn't mean edgy. It means you're doing something differently. And I think that's where the kind of confusion is. It's like not being disruptive for the sake of it.
And I think it comes down to what motivates the people that run those businesses. And we at Propercorn, we used to talk about being stocked everywhere you could buy a packet of Walkers, because that's the point at which we were truly offering healthy alternatives. Like, to be a true healthy alternative, you have to be available as an alternative everywhere you're choosing an unhealthy choice. For Moju to be in Greggs, that's presumably about making like a ginger shot part of everyone's ritual. And for that to be the case, you have to be in McDonald's, you have to be everywhere that those morning rituals are taking place. And I just feel like I'm going to slip into like very judgmental territory, but I think there are businesses that fundamentally don't get out of bed to do that. They get out of bed to win the design awards and to be part of the scene. And that's fine. That's a very different objective. My ask is that they're explicit. That's their real objective. And that they're like, that they structure their business behind that and that there's no tension in it. And they're not the businesses that light me up. Like, I'm much more interested in trying to do something like a slightly more meaningful scale.
Totally. And I think that's the thing with Better For You, the challenge I've always had with it is where I've spent my whole career, because it means something to me, because I think marketing can be a bit of a dark art. You're essentially getting people to pay for something, to buy more of something. And so to do it for healthier food, then for me is great. But the problem is the price point. All of those brands, majority, still sit at a super premium price point. And I think when we watch Pop Chips sell, go mainstream, go full gondola end and Asda, being cross-priced with Fanta, and part of me is like, oh, it was my really premium brand. And then, but actually, that's how it should be. If you're serious about wanting people to make healthier choices, you need to be available in Greggs. You need to be available in McDonald's. You need to be at a price point that a mainstream price point. That's where the volume shifts and the meaningful change happens. And it doesn't, obviously, you can't start there for a lot of startup brands, but that's what the end goal should be, I think. Not for everybody, like you say, but just be honest about it then.
I think we have to start naming the implicit elitism in the way we all think. So to say we're shocked that Moji wanted to be in Greggs, that's actually quite terrible.
Sorry.
But no, as in that's not an exceptional point of view. But I think, and I don't know whether the industry is ever going to get to this, but that shouldn't be okay. Yeah. We should recognize that desire to live longer and be healthier is not shaped by household income.
I don't think it was shocking to me for that. I think it was shocking because I've never heard it before, which is shocking. That it's still shouldn't be the goal, that it's not widely admitted, that's not the goal. That's not the goal people are setting out for themselves, is to become a mainstream household brand when it should be, for loads of reasons. And maybe I am a bit snobby about Greggs as well. So.
No, but that shows how insular the marketing industry can be.
Yeah.
And to back to my point on, like, just be customer led. Know how your customer behaves, like your core customer, your growth audience. And if your growth audience have one set pattern, then you absolutely have to embed yourself in that pattern, even if it's a million miles away from your day to day, because you live in zone 2 and your world looks very different, or you have an affluent commute into your meetings from Guildford. Yeah, I think, like, the customer centric thinking behind that is really inspiring.
And just getting out of London, for God's sake, get out of London. Doing cold
brew, do anything.
Get out of London, speak to some people. And it's hard because obviously London's such a huge market. But again, if you want to be mainstream, if you want to work in Tesco Hull, which you should as a FMCG brand, then you need to understand a broader range of consumers. And I agree with you. When you get those briefs, it's a lot more exciting. We've got a few brands we're talking to at the moment that are going in at a much lower mainstream price point. And I'm like, this is exciting, because this is also where real change happens, is in the mainstream, not with the worried well, who are already snacking healthily anyway. So you're not switching them out from anything. You're just giving them another option. Okay.
Yeah.
Move on before we get too controversial.
Stop.
Is there one thing you wish founders understood about marketing? More founders understood about marketing?
It's a really interesting question. I wish I'm sure there's many. The thing that comes to my head is I wish they understood how commercial it is and how we can't do our jobs unless we really understand how this business works. I think we let ourselves be sidelined as important off doing our creative thing on the side. So I get really cross with people talking about brand building. But I think marketing managers have this habit of being like, sorry, finance director, like, you can't ask me those questions because it's unmeasurable, because I'm brand building, as though it's this, like, untouchable, sacrosanct space that is above rigor of questioning. And I think we do that to ourselves. It's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. We do that to ourselves a bit, and businesses allow us to sit there. And actually, if we don't understand margin, we don't understand margin evolution, we don't understand what the commercial goals really are. Really, do we have to come straight back to the conversation we had? Do we have to work nationwide with a rate of sale target of X by this deadline? Or can this business survive as a London-centric brand? Is there a big enough market there? Can I just focus on share of existing healthy consumers, or do I need to be doing something different? Like, we can't make those decisions without real candid insight into how those businesses are run. And I think it's sometimes not understood where that curiosity comes from. And I wish founders like saw a little bit of that curiosity in their marketing teams and pulled the doors open and said, thank you so much for starting to ask these questions. Come right on in. Let me explain everything to you. Let me really educate you, because that's such an olive branch for a marketer. Like, often that's very out of their depths. And I think especially for junior teams who are really starting to flex those muscles, they need that to be really embraced. And there's this kind of, it's a kind of different version of that competitive tension we talked about earlier. It's like almost this like confidential tension within a business. And I think that's really unconstructive.
I had this exact conversation on a previous episode with Reese, who was my finance director at PopChips and then this commercial officer at Simply Roasted and is now CEO at Ocean Saver. And we talked about, we've always worked really harmoniously together. So me as the marketing director, him as the finance director, essentially, and how rare that is. But also, I think you get that when you work in good startups and scale-ups, you can't not learn about other functions if they're run properly, and they should be hand in hand. It shouldn't be. You hear it about sales and marketing as well. It's like, ooh, sales and marketing. Mm. That's crazy. It's crazy. Sales and marketing. Mm. You know, marketing should be seen in the business as a growth engine, not a cost center. And I think until that switch is flipped, it's just not going to work. But your job as the marketing is to show how, why, to sell it in, and to take everybody on that journey and be the leader for that. And you have to invest the time to do that.
Yeah. You have to do your internal marketing job really well. But I think there's a huge difference between not good or bad founders, but founders who come to the conversation with one view of marketing and founders who come to the conversation with a different view of marketing. And yes, a good marketeer should be able to convince a founder otherwise, but God, it's a distraction. Like, how much nicer is it to do that in a business where you can just do your external job and actually focus on delivering the growth, not convincing everyone you're delivering growth?
Yeah, it'd be nice, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, coming to the end now. So I'm going to ask you just a couple more questions, a bit more quick fire. If you could whisper something to yourself 5 years ago, what would it be?
Just that it's all going to be okay. Just be like, it's all right, hon. You're doing really well. Not in a bad way. I think at every stage of my career, I'm about to turn 35 and I think I feel really chill. Like, I've got loads of ambition, but I'm also very content. And all I ever wanted was to run a business that meant that I could do interesting work, work with people I loved and pay for my life. And I did that a while ago. I had this like little list of what that meant. And one of them was like, get a PT. There were a few others on it, but what I remember, one of them was get a PT. And I had a personal trainer who was a friend of mine from when I used to live in Delhi, who was really reasonable. And I'd have my PT sessions 3 times a week. And it was costing me like, the vision of get a PT was be able to spend 80 quid 3 times a week and be that kind of level of rich. And I hadn't achieved that at all, but I'd got to the goals. And it was like, I was like, that's just so the way I was always going to do it. Yes, I was going to hit all the goals, but I was not going to hit anything. No, that was my simple strategy, right? I hit the goals, but I did not, all of the implicit stuff that was also true at that point wasn't true at all. So I'm just really content.
Good.
So I'd tell myself to see that.
Brand you're obsessed with right now?
I don't know if I should say. We had a conversation with the Ottolenghi team yesterday that I wasn't even in the call on, but the fact that I know that it happened, I was like, that's so cool. So that I'm really excited by. I'd quite like to do some sort of active wear or menopausal supplement, or I really want to do something for a different customer. I'm working for a hair care brand that's very clear that they're talking to a very underserved market, and I'm finding that really energizing. So more of that, please, universe.
Marketing hill you'd die on?
Customers always, there's never too much time spent hanging out with your customer. Get into their house, get on that train, go around for a cup of tea. It's always worth it.
Out of London.
Yeah.
And then,
yeah, not the overground.
And then finally, question we're asking everyone, in your opinion, what makes a brand of tomorrow?
I don't think anything different to what made a brand of yesterday and 100 years ago.
Whoa. Great, great.
I'm just not, AI's not going to get us. We're fine.
Let's revisit in 5 years and see if we're...
and mock me publicly. No, look, the way that the Pantones and the places they show up and the channels and all of that's going to change. But what makes a brand is what's always made a brand, which is having an actual solution to a problem that is painful for someone and knowing who that person is.
Love it. Thank you so much for coming on, Lottie.
Such a pleasure.
And if you enjoyed that, you have your own podcast, which people can listen to, where you speak to founders and marketing leaders.
I do. Yes, The Marketing Hustle. I've interviewed 62 founders over 4 very insightful years, and I'm about to do a series with marketing directors and CMOs to get kind of one level further in, because I had some interesting feedback that the founders don't always know the detail, which I thought was fascinating. So we're going into the detail with marketing directors. And then Ruth, will you have me back in 5 years' time so you can mock me for how my predictions were so wrong?
Sooner than that, let's see.
Oh, I don't know. We're both busy women.
All right,
we will see each other a lot. Thank you for having me.